Roughly 30 years before this short story was written, The Machine Stops. If you see it here, you can all look at it afterwards. Mark Twain was approached in his finest hour, having just published Tom Sawyer. He was approached by a young inventor who asked him to invest in a new idea he had and a new company that he was starting the following year. Mark Twain knocked him back in no uncertain terms and told him that his invention was rubbish, no one would ever use it, and he had no intention of investing any of his money in such a foolish enterprise. The inventor was Alexander Graham Bell, the invention was a telephone, and the company was AT&T, which today owns 4 out of every 5 telephones in the United States. I mention this because on the one hand we have a sort of people have a sort of Luddite, anti-technological attitude or fear of technology or what it might imply. On the other hand, I can also mention that in the 1960s and 70s, somebody mentioned the other day encyclopedia salesmen, and one job you could always get was to sell encyclopedias. And people bought these encyclopedias, but who ever read them? Who actually used the information database, which an encyclopedia is? Well, people didn't really read them, they were status symbols. So I mention these two things to give you two opposing viewpoints on how people are likely to look at the internet. On the one hand, maybe this fantastic opportunity. On the other hand, it might be a bit of a toy, something that isn't going to be that serious. The question I'm going to try and answer is the internet going to be good for democracy? I'll put some headings up here, which doesn't matter if you can't see them, because I'll be covering the points. I'll start with the arguments in favour of this. I don't know what I put up, right? Why the internet will be good for democracy. The arguments in favour of it, first of all. Now, having looked at the internet myself, you can get an absolute ton of material on this subject. And my problem is I'm going to have to be careful of my time and not to say too much. I've been busy crossing out huge sections. You can get tons of material on just about anything, but on the question of the internet and democracy, consult the internet itself. For anybody interested, I've got huge bibliographies, links to democracy sites, censorship sites, all that kind of thing. So be assured that this is a debate that is occurring on the internet as we speak. What is it that you need for good democracy? We've heard some explanations this weekend. Freedom of information will obviously be a crucial one. Freedom of information and the press, equality of access, inclusivity of participation. Three things I've put here. Freedom of information, I'll give you one quote. A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce. That was James Madison, 4th President of the United States. James Mill, a utilitarian thinker, said that an accurate report of what is done by the representatives, a transcript of their speeches, a statement of his propositions, is necessary to be laid before the people. Nobody, we presume, will deny. This requires the use of the cheapest means of communication, and we add the free use of those means. And he was writing in the 1750s, but he could equally well have been writing about email and about the internet. What democracy relies on, therefore, is the free use of those means, the equal and free use. Everyone's equal in death and in cyberspace. It's a great leveler. Huge corporations can access the net, but so can small active protest groups. One government think tank, I can't quote you who it was, recently produced a report that showed that the activists on the net are far better networked and far better organized than government agencies. I'll give you one example from a recent Guardian article. Last month, 12 environmental justice protesters and a video activist walked into Shell UK's London headquarters and occupied 3 offices. The first thing the undercurrents reporter did was to set up his small digital camera and link it to a palm-top computer and a mobile phone. Despite Shell turning off the electricity and cutting the phone lines, within minutes he was broadcasting the protest live on the internet and emailing it to the mainstream press. By the time they were evicted a few hours later, 5 broadcasts had been made. Similarly, the multilateral agreement on investment, which was a secret negotiation, secret meeting by various countries of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, was exposed by a French non-government organization. Within days, the ramifications of this treaty were broadcast around the world on the internet. The campaign to stop it depended on the web and spread like wildfire. After 2 years, more than 600 citizens groups, including unions, consumer organizations, development and environment groups, and dozens of countries were on the case, coordinating opposition, alerting politicians, the media, and so forth. Last November, the negotiations were finally abandoned. The statement was that the governments were ambushed by the detail of the information coming at them. What this shows is that the potential for democracy and for protest and for sort of political activity that we especially engage in is undoubtedly going to be facilitated by access to information on this scale. This is like nothing we've ever encountered before. As you know, this is like an encyclopedia, but a post office, a telephone, a telecommunications centre, all those things all rolled into one. Not unsurprisingly then, there's a large political agenda associated with much of the writing that you see on the internet. A lot of people who are writing about the future have got this democracy agenda. And they get very excited about it. The fact that everyone can be published, the fact that it's hard or virtually impossible to censor. This enthusiasm is typical of a large group of idealists, I would call them, computer idealists, who are variously known as cyber pundits, or in a phrase that I particularly like, digirati. To this group, the internet is almost a dream come true, the greatest revolution in popular democracy since the printing press. And it's hard not to be excited by the implications of this communications revolution for a previously unheard of level of popular or direct democracy. I'll spare you the quotes, but many writers believe that we are now embarking on an age of direct democracy, the ability of every individual to vote directly and affect their government's decisions. A lot of these people believe that they already have a sort of democracy, and that one of the definitions of democracy is, like computers, it can always build better versions of itself. It can improve itself. So all you need is a democracy to begin with, and you can improve it. It's pointed out that the idea of direct democracy through telecommunications goes back to the 1940s. Buckminster Fuller first proposed voting on issues of the day by telephone. One characteristic quotation that I'll give you from René Thorberg's thesis in 1995, entitled On Information and Communications Technology and Democracy. He says this, and I think this sums up their position. Representative democracy was founded because of physical distances that made it impossible to maintain direct contact with one's supporters. Now, these contacts can be maintained electronically. So we can gradually start to move away from a representative democracy. The result will be a self-governing society, with its people behind the electronic steering wheel. Well, in my view, this argument could only really have been put forward by an American thinking of the great plains or the deserts or the huge expanses of wilderness between different people. You'd hardly expect somebody who lived in Hackney to come up with an argument about democracy being defeated by distance. And in fact, other writers, although nevertheless enthusiastic about the idea of direct democracy, aren't quite as naive as that. Another writer, Evan Schwartz, writes this: our founding fathers, in their white wigs, feared that the lower classes would vote to seize their property, so they intentionally created a representative republic, not a full-fledged democracy, to keep power out of the hands of the masses. Well, there we approach more the real matter. It isn't a matter of geography, it's a matter of class. And that's something that these what I would call direct democracy idealists are not sufficiently aware of. So that's what the enthusiasts think about it. What are the governments doing about it? What are the capitalist governments responding with at the moment? Well, they're making an effort. I'll show you here a couple of sites that deal with this. If you look at the bottom one first, you can see that. This is the UK Citizens Online Democracy Project. In theory it's independent, but in practice it works with the government, and it's got a little nice section here. The Tony Blair has his say, and he says nice things about the Have Your Say website, if you can see that. It's a historic opportunity for the public to play a meaningful part in the blah 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 and all the rest of it, and that's really nice. Unfortunately, one Labour MP in a recent article wasn't quite so positive about this. She says, "The House of Commons is one of the most unwired places there is," says Labour MP Margaret Moran. We're still in the era of the quill pen here. Other countries, of course, are doing similar things. In America, the Clinton administration has gone in for online voting, electronic town councils, and all this sort of thing. There are similar initiatives going on in dozens of places around the world, from Barcelona to Costa Rica, so on and so forth. New Zealand, Australia, Nova Scotia, all these things are going on. Very nice, you might think. The government is, you know, making some effort. If you look at the American sites that are actually better than the British sites, you know how to contact the White House, the Pentagon, your local governors, the Senate, anybody. It's all in one page, and via links you can go anywhere. So if you really wanted to write to all these people, it's being made much easier for you by the government itself. Well, that's all very nice, isn't it? What isn't quite so nice, of course, is the way that governments are also trying to censor the internet. This is obviously a cause of great worry. And they're doing it, predictably, by using pornography, hate mail, and national security as cover arguments. Criminal activities on the net, they talk about. Well, of course, these things do exist, but, I mean, in the case of hate mail, you can't really prevent people being rude to each other. It doesn't really take legislation. In the case of pornography, well, you can't prevent it on the net any more than you can stop it being printed and put in bookshops. But nevertheless, they are doing their damnedest to do something to bring in restrictions. In particular, it was remarkable. Again, I can't give you the names, I can't remember. The scientist who invented the public key encryption process was given a prize by the American Trade Council, and as he took his little trophy, he said, "Well, this is ironic that I'm being given a prize by the same state that next year is planning to prosecute me for this same invention." And indeed they were. The government's not very happy about public key encryption because it means they can't monitor us. Interestingly, the US federal judges recently overturned Clinton's Communications Decency Act, ruling that, and I quote, "The strength of our liberty depends on the chaos and cacophony of the unfettered speech the First Amendment protects. As the most participatory form of mass speech yet developed, the internet deserves the highest protection from government intrusion." Nevertheless, the government sent an appeal to the Supreme Court. They're not going to give up that easily. Independent organisations have sprung up, of course, to monitor government intrusion and government attempts at censorship. And here we find one such group, TOP, the Centre for Democracy and Technology. I needn't go into that. There's a few sites. You can see what you can do. You can make a difference. Read about wiretapping, cryptography, data privacy, and so forth. So just as the government is trying to haul in its cack-handed and clumsy attempts to censor the net, of course the net responds with this kind of thing. So it isn't a one-way, it's not one-way traffic anymore. The governments haven't got it all their own way this time. In the middle here you've got the direct Democracy Online project, which is trying to persuade people that direct democracy is a perfectly feasible way of running society. They don't say running capitalism, but that's what they mean. So I think I've covered the arguments in favour of more democracy on the net. If I could, I'll just summarise that by saying the assumption that you can run capitalism with this sort of idea of direct democracy is a non-starter. Internet or no internet, this isn't going to happen because the governments don't want this to happen. That isn't how class society, that isn't a freedom that class society allows. There are other arguments against it, of course. The idea of a cacophonous exchange of debate on every piddling little issue, local, national and global, would be inconceivable. It would be hard, as Peter already pointed out in his talk, it would be hard to conceive of people making decisions about absolutely everything all the time. You just wouldn't get anything else done. And a lot of people made this point. The internet isn't there for this sort of thing. The arguments against them, I'm sorry if this begins to look a little bit bleak at times. It's not going to be bleak, but first, a warning against too much enthusiasm. Here's a quote for you. According to one to much web rhetoric, everything in history has pointed to the classless, godless, bossless utopia of the internet. The gospel of the internet speaks of breaking down barriers and building bridges, of bringing people together and abolishing hierarchy. The internet is not a mere means of communication, it is a tool of liberation. Somebody else says, in an article, Wired Words, images of the golden age of American democracy are conjured up. The ghosts of Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine are revived. Visions of electronic town hall meetings and a new age of conversation are laid out. The new technology becomes synonymous with the democratic past. So just as people indulge in golden ages of the past, so some people are indulging in a golden age of the future. But as I think I should be able to show, it's not quite the golden age that they think. In the first place, there is the question, and I've heard a few people this weekend say this, that the internet isn't necessarily that liberating a process. After all, when you think about what you're doing if you're using the internet, you're usually isolated, you're usually on your own in a room. It's not a team sport. It's a solo thing. What you can imagine, and which is why I had the piece about the machine stops at the beginning, is this sort of nightmare scenario of people becoming locked into their houses. They could almost board up their windows and never go out. They could book all their shopping by the internet. They could work through the internet. They'd never have to leave their house at all. I can imagine they'd be maybe allowed out once a week on Friday night and herded into the local heavily guarded clubs or discos to have a few fights, beat each other up, get drunk, and then go home and stay the next 7 days in their cell. The image I hope we don't see is something like this. Progress actually sends us backwards. Incidentally, these caves that you can see are very well carved out. They're quite respectable things, and the society of these so-called troglodytes was actually very, as it says there, a sophisticated urban culture. So when I say that we may be moving into becoming electronic cavemen, I'm not necessarily being very rude about cavemen, although I am being quite rude about us. So, virtual communities or electronic cavemen? Well, this brings up questions that I don't really feel within my remit to talk about what is community? What is communication? In many ways, these things are not possible to deal with by the internet, and claims that are made about virtual communities, for myself, I'm unconvinced. To me, a community is real people talking in real language, face to face. A machine cannot replace real interaction, and people who think that it can, I think, are in danger of losing sight of what it means to be a human being. However, having said that, we have to look at some of the ideas behind the enthusiasts for internet. And it's odd actually that although I showed you that picture of troglodytes and cavemen, many of the people who are most enthusiastic about the internet see it in terms of metaphors of travel, of frontiers. They see themselves as the new frontiersmen. The way they even talk about it, one of the grand old men of the internet, Harold Reingold, who's quoted all over the place. His work is based on strong themes of which run back, if you're interested, to the Chicago School of Communications, started in the 1880s, which saw communications as rather like the head and body politic model of the Romans. The communications is the nervous system. And Reingold's idea is a fairly typical one of travel, and they talk about the Wild West, the new frontiers, and all this sort of thing. Which is an odd paradox, considering you're not actually going anywhere. You're sitting behind a desk, you're very isolated, as I said before. There's no travel involved. Ideas may be traveling, electronic signals may be traveling, but you're staying still. So it seems a peculiar sort of metaphor that they use. They also use things like, they call the internet the electronic frontier. Other people call it the electronic agora, referring to the marketplace of ideas in ancient Athens. And in fact, electronic marketplace is another term that they use. People have got quite different viewpoints on what it is that they think the internet can be used for. And a lot of misplaced technological utopianism, I think, is present. So how do we take some of the claims of the internet then? I think we take them with a pinch of salt, to be honest. The idea of community, I think I've already dealt with to some extent. I'll just give you a few ideas. Does the shrinking world necessarily expand our power? Communities based on mutual interests can form political will, but if they're physically separated, they nevertheless can't enforce that political will necessarily. Some writers point to this alienation on the web. They go so far as to say that world community is a myth, virtual community is a myth, that we will be held up by linguistic differences, by cultural differences, that it's impossible to transcend on the web. So other people also say that we take our baggage into the web with us. I don't know whether you know, but people who use AOL are generally regarded as a bit thick. There is a new form of domainism in the web. And that's why whenever you see AOL readers, users, they always become the subject of hate mail and flaming and all this sort of thing. It's almost unfair, really. So, participation, better discussion, egalitarian exchange, open society, these are all the sort of things that ought to be, or ought to be possible, or at least potential. But in the case of participation, what do we find in the real world? We have voter apathy. I won't bore you with the voting figures for the last elections, you all know what they are, so I don't need to prove that point. To do with participation, again, there's a deterioration in the quality of discussion and ideas in the public sphere. The public sphere has become, and many writers and commentators have noted this, has become invaded by corporate advertising to the point where they are the creators of opinion. How can you have a rational discussion in the public sphere when you're being bombarded by advertising? The subvertising group reckon that in America people are bombarded by 3,000 adverts every day. There's also the problem that people are anonymous on the net. Now, you can't have a community of anonymous people. People can disguise themselves as other people. Well, you can't have that if you're going to have a proper democratic voting system. So there's that problem. That's more alienating than anything in the real world, arguably. And in spite of what some people say about democracy making us all more powerful, other people think that, in fact, we'll be more passive. The Critical Art Ensemble is an online activist group. suggests that the elite stronghold will remain, the corporate stronghold will remain on the internet, and that most of the first world population will join the electronic public sphere primarily as passive consumers rather than active participants. They'll be playing computer games, watching interactive TV, and shopping in virtual malls. The stratified distribution of education will act as the guardian of the virtual border between the passive and the active user. In fact, in a recent case study of the public electronic network in Santa Monica in California, which was an online democracy exercise, 3,000 people signed up, but only 50 actively participated. Better quality discussion? Well, as I already said, not if the ideas that are dominating the whole thing are those of the corporate advertisers. Better quality discussion? Not if it's all going to be done by keystroke. If people are just going to vote by keystroke without any commitment to a proper discussion, it's not likely to be better discussion just because it's more available. And again, how the opinion's being formed? Well, you know, I've covered that point. Egalitarian exchange. Are people more equal on the internet? Well, they are more equal, but not entirely so. There's still class. There's still the dominant ideology. There is still the fact that most of the internet is dominated by, one quote here, by white, well-off, English-speaking, educated males, most of whom are US citizens. This is the same group that dominates most of the first world society, and you may as well add this is the same group that dominates ideology. According to the Cyber Atlas site, the average internet user is a 32-year-old white male, 64% have at least a college degree, 41% are married, 87% are white, and 73% are in the USA. Okay, so what about, I think I've dealt with I've covered the ground for the possibilities for greater democracy, for better discussion. Yes, all these things are possible, but you have to bear these qualifications in mind. Now, on the subject of open society, we return again to the idea of censorship. Never mind more democracy on the net, what about less? How could they use it against us? Well, in one really excellent thesis, which I can recommend by Alinta Thornton on the internet, where she deals with this sort of thing. She talks about the problem of the service provider Prodigy. Now, there are a lot of service providers, so those of you all know that they're all pretty much the same, but Prodigy was an early one, commercial, advert-driven, heavily censored. It accessed the user's PC, it could extract information from the user's PC, and it generally was regarded as a scary preview of what might happen if a few large companies come to dominate the internet. Interesting though, Prodigy subscribers themselves actually revolted against this control by their ISP. Thornton talks about the panopticon, the all-seeing eye, the idea of Big Brother, that the governments and states can use the internet to watch us rather than us watching them. And rather than Wild West scenarios, one other writer suggests that what we're talking about here is the Badlands. That the information superhighway is more like a 19th century railroad that passes through the Badlands of the Old West, whose travellers are easy marks for sharpers. He points out that most things on the internet are still based on trust. But emails can be read by others. People can fabricate names or pretend to be other people. So, you know, someone could pretend to be you and send a fascistic email to the local press, something like that. Email can be forged tracelessly. There's no possibility of tracing it. Impersonators can slander you. Criminal acts can be committed in your name. But the state has a lot of potential to tyrannize us through this. I'll give you a quote from Foucault on discipline and punish. Just as the ability to read and write and freely communicate gives power to citizens that protects them from the powers of the state, the ability to survey, to invade the citizens' privacy, gives the state the power to confuse, coerce, and control citizens. Uneducated populations cannot rule themselves, but tyrannies can control even educated populations given sophisticated means of surveillance. And we have, in the internet, a potential sophisticated means of surveillance. We also have the problem that we are living in capitalism and that everything becomes commodified in capitalism. In fact, the internet is a commodity itself. Everything becomes a script on the internet. Advertising and PR have undermined the public sphere, according to one writer, by supplanting genuine discourse with fake discourse, leading to radical deterioration in the public sphere. This is the kind of thing I was on about before. Real ideas aren't being debated. It's all advertising, it's all front, it's all hype. It's becoming more and more that way. We just become the observers. Steve Coleman made a point about democracy not being a spectator sport, something that you watch, and yet the internet is becoming increasingly something that you watch, you spectate. We merely sit there and watch while the internet providers amaze us with the latest electronic wonders. There's a rush to commercialise on the internet. Forrester Research reports that the total annual internet-related revenues have increased from $300 million in 1994 to $10 billion this year. It's an ideal forum for public relations. Thousands of companies are going on the web not to sell anything, but to improve their public relations, to improve customer brand loyalty, to promote positive image, and also to collect demographic information about the customer. So, now the cooperative idea of the internet's original instigators is clashing with this with capitalism. And capitalism will find ways of using the internet, which we can't stop, but we can certainly predict. They will use it to provide, for example, the search engines, make them easy, make us more and more the passive user who has to just click a button and finds all the entertainment they can possibly want. So it's just going to be like a large interactive TV. So what have we got? Participation, greater participation, maybe. Better discussion, probably not. Egalitarian exchange, a little bit, but not too much. Open society, well, that remains to be fought for. So, in conclusion, I think I'll bring this to a close. What are the good points, then? I'll leave you with the good things about the internet, the things that we can focus on for the future. I'll quote this this bloke, Schuler, who had some good things to say about this. He said, many digerati seem to believe that the internet is inherently democratic. Sadly, most signs indicate that the internet is becoming less, not more democratic. And he argues that government is becoming less relevant anyway as the corporations start to take over, with something that we've certainly thought ourselves. People are becoming too passive. They won't take advantage of the democratic opportunities offered to them. He says, democracy is not a commodity like shampoo or dog food. Democracy, he says, is not a noun. It's more like a verb. It implies that you do something. And he says democracy is atrophying like an unused muscle due to the privately owned media. The best communications technology, in his opinion, is your vocal cords. So with that in mind, I'll just sum up a few of the key things about the internet which really are different, which really are revolutionary, and then I shall sit down. Interactivity. One writer says this, it would be interesting to see the impact of individual article ratings in a newspaper. For example, an editor would be sure to look askance at a columnist whose individual ratings were poor, whose readers constantly questioned the facts presented, or whose opinions were seen as irrelevant or distasteful. Interactivity, so that's a good point. Structure. The internet structure means that it will always be difficult for conglomerate telecommunications or media organizations to gain the type of control currently that they exercise over all other media. Even if they take control of all the internet service providers, they will never be able to exercise that complete domination of the internet that they have always had on newspapers and TV. It's possible that a few big corporations could take it over. But it's also possible that, again, as I think Steve Common mentioned in his talk about TV, that the age of the mass audience may well be over. And if that's true, then the age of mass communication is also over. And what you might find is that the idea of mass media has to be revised, and that communications takes place in, rather than large companies to large groups of viewers, you'll have smaller niche companies publishing and communicating to niche markets of speciality interests on the web. So you may see a fragmentation of society taking place. Compared to the traditional media, obviously, people have so much more access to debate and opportunities for the formation of political will and political ideas. They'll have access to information that is hard or virtually impossible to obtain by any other means. You only have to think of, if you want the addresses of MI6 agents, well, we all know where to go for that. MI5 had their private hotline published on the internet a couple of years ago, and the newspapers phoned them up and said, "Did you know about this?" And they said, "Oh no, thank you for mentioning it, we'll change our number." One can worry about censorship, but the current state of censorship on the web is laughable. I'll give you a couple of examples. They try to filter out websites by looking for certain keywords. Unfortunately, you end up with sites dealing with, say, Mars exploration being spiked because it's got the letters sex in it. Another filter mechanism changes certain keywords that are regarded as dangerous, so that one site that mentioned the actor Dick Van Dyke had to change his name to Jerk Van Gay. So we are not dealing with Big Brother yet, and arguably we never will have to deal with that. There are virtual communities on the net. In spite of what I say about my concern about us becoming cavemen, there are useful things that virtual communities do. If you think about the fact that over 60% of internet users are reckoned to be over 40, it's not young people that are taking on the internet. Surprisingly, it's older people. It's people who are housebound. It's people who are disabled. It's people with who can't see and can't hear. It's ethnic minorities, people who, it's especially women who can disguise their identity, pretend to be men on the net, people who are normally disempowered in society, who have most to gain by taking up this technology. So it isn't fair to say that virtual community is a myth entirely. And some virtual community groups and news groups have a very strong following, committed following. Our own Socialist Forum is just beginning to take off now, and a few people are taking part in that. We hope in the future that will become a very exciting, dynamic area for party discussion. And that creates a sense of community, which is very difficult in a party where a lot of people are in the central branch and isolated. So that's a good thing. About the commodification of the internet, we can do nothing. We know what capitalism's like, we expect this, we're not surprised by it, but we have to say that it isn't just their medium, it's also our medium. We can use it too. And as I said right at the beginning, death and the internet, we're all equal in cyberspace. We can attack them, we can get at them too. And I have plenty of examples of people here using the internet to attack government or to acquire information that embarrasses corporations. It's all so much easier now than it was 10 years ago. So, and even the argument that it's exclusive, let me just deal with this last point, it's exclusive, it's white middle class males, that's going to disappear. In fact, I would be prepared to give you a prediction that in the next 2 or 3 years, local phone calls in Britain will be free. In fact, a lot of people are predicting that computers will be free. The part of the process of capitalist commercialization and commodification is that they need us to use the internet. They need us to use it. It isn't an option anymore. They have to get us online. And a lot of people are saying that, don't forget, computers are becoming so cheap anyway. You can now buy an internet machine for 50 quid second hand. That why not make it free? Well, they may or may not make the computers free, but I think that the pressure will be to make the local calls free. Commentators have variously predicted this sort of thing. My final, in conclusion then, I'll say, and thank you for your patience, is that the internet is going to become an essential item in every home, just like the washing machine, just like your TV and your fridge. In fact, it will replace the TV most likely. We'd never think of going back and doing democracy the hard way afterwards. It would be inconceivable to go back. But in spite of what I've said about the potentials and the dangers of the internet, the battles still have to be won, and the will still has to be there. And the internet isn't going to be a magic wand for revolutionaries, but it is going to make the struggle for knowledge, which is the essential thing that we need to concentrate on, it's going to make that easier, and it's therefore it must make change in society more likely rather than less. Thank you very much.